Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
You almost forgot my name. I heard that little pause there, and you almost forgot my name.
I forgot who I was here with. You know, sometimes I just wish I was alone.
Goodness. I know how you feel. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How you doing?
I'm well, thanks. And you?
I'm doing pretty well. As you know, I'm addicted to the TiVo now.
That's, oh, yeah.
The TiVo is the best creation in the world for me.
Yes.
I can watch whatever I want in my time.
Uh-huh.
2 a.m.
Right.
You know, get home from work at 3 a.m. The other day I got home at 3:30 in the morning and put a show on till 5 o'clock in the morning. And it didn't have to be an infomercial.
Right,
it just
right.
Got to, you know, it just right. Got to be whatever I want it to be. And I TiVo'd Top Chef,
mm-hmm.
which is the new season's on and is playing and it's on its way. And I just... You know, they did the thing again in Top Chef, and this was the I watched the first episode, so I'm a bunch behind. And they did the thing again in Top Chef where they put a culinary student in with all the chefs.
Yeah.
And I just keep wondering why they're doing that, okay? Because I don't care what culinary student you are. If you're with real chefs, if you're with people who are established in the industry, maybe you'll be better than two of them.
Mm.
But
probably not.
But you're not going to get down to the final 10. You're not going to get down to the final 5. There's no way.
Yeah, well, you know why? And I have to say, as you all out there in listening land know, we're not fans of reality TV in general. Mm-hmm. But we like Top Chef. And I think a lot of good comes out of Top Chef. Yeah. I think there's a lot of insight that people can gain. And young. I think it's a good influence on young people. I like Top Chef and I like Colicchio a lot. But I think there's a certain amount of, number one, you're taking that one in a million chance that the culinary student shines and you win the lottery. The show wins the lottery, everybody watched it, everybody's going to root for that person. But it's also like the reason on American Idol that they let some people who are horrendous get a little further down.
Yeah,
so you can cringe a little at home and go, oh.
One of the things I see with Top Chef, the show, is that it's getting better. Okay, the contestants on it as a whole are getting better. You know, they always had a few good people, but it seems like it's getting better. But one thing that the show points out that I think is so important in this industry. And it's almost like a basic skills when you're talking about restaurants or being a chef.
Mm-hmm.
And it's knife skills. And the very first episode was a knife skills. It was paring an apple with a knife rather than a peeler.
Uh-huh.
And see who could do 15 apples the right way, the fastest. And then the bottom 8 people had to do Brunoise, which is a small dice in perfect
very,
fashion.
Very, very fine dice, yeah.
And here's what I'll tell you, okay? The winner of Top Chef, okay, they split you. There were 17 people to begin with, okay? And the top 9 got immunity for top 9 people pairing apples got immunity. And then the top 4 people making Brunoise got immunity.
Yeah.
And then the bottom 4 people fought it out. But here's what I can tell you. I can almost guarantee to you that the winner of Top Chef is going to be one of those first 8 people or 9
You're
people.
Right. You can peel an apple. It can core an apple.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because those are the basic skills of being a chef. And great chefs have great basic skills. Like a great mathematician can multiply large numbers in his head easily. A great chef can break down chickens or dice apples or if you're truly a great chef, it's not just a creative side. You also have the physical and the practical side.
Well, and also if you look at it, it's sort of like modern art. You know, by someone who has mastered the classic techniques and goes beyond them, I think is sometimes in this age of molecular gastronomy confused. I remember talking with a chef who shall remain nameless. Chef is kind of a, I guess, you know, everybody else calls him that. But he's a guy who got really into what he saw as avant-garde. He had kiwi. What was it? We did a benefit with him, and he had kiwi with some sort of seafood, like an oily fish.
I don't remember.
And it was just, and the guy didn't have the basic skills.
Uh-huh.
So Wiley Dufresne, who puts together wacky things and wacky combinations that are that sort of broaden the box, he knows the basics,
yep.
and he's expanding them. Just throwing stuff, you know, throwing paint on a wall does not make you Jackson Pollock.
Right.
You know, and so, yes, I agree entirely.
So I think that one of the cool things is you have this kind of going back to the basics. You know, let's start at square one. You need to be able to do A, B, and C before you can do D. You know, Francis and I, culinary school is very expensive right now. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult way to start off your culinary career. But one thing they do
oh, is Lord.
They start with the basics, and one of the purposes of going to culinary school is to learn those basic skills that are truly the building blocks of being a great chef.
Well,
those basic sauces. And that's how it is. Cooking, to be a great chef, you've got to build on a foundation.
But you can also learn those things if you'll find a chef who will take you
for
on
sure.
as an apprentice. The problem is, it's very hard for a young person to know. I'm not saying it's impossible. You've got to do your research. But if you want to get into this business through the apprenticeship route, you certainly can do that still. And it's a heck of a lot cheaper to go to work for somebody for free or for nothing or for minimum wage for years while you learn your craft. Because I tell you what, when you go to CIA, not only do you work for nothing, you pay them $30,000 a year, $40,000 a year.
That's a lot.
But as far as the basic skills, I completely agree with you.
You know, we talked about the Michael Pollan article a couple of times, you and me together, and a little bit
on the
show.
The one he wrote recently in the Times.
The one he wrote recently in the Times. But one of his recommendations is that we offer a subsidy to culinary students, and that those culinary students, a lot like the Army, where you have to give back and join the Army for a couple of years, you have to give back and cook in the schools.
Well, and, you know, look.
In order to, so if you get your 2-year culinary degree that is paid for by the government, subsidized by the government, you've got to then commit yourself to work for 2 years in a school or a place where, of public accommodation like that, but a school or university or some place like that where you've got to give back.
Well, and teaching people about food basically, makes for a healthier nation. I mean, even if we just cook for ourselves. But I have to say about Top Chef, I think as the show continues on, I didn't realize, you know, we've had in prior years, we've had every contestant of Top Chef on the show. We had Colicchio on the show in the first and second
every
year.
Every winner of Top Chef.
Every winner, yeah. I didn't realize that it was going to go on and be this existing franchise
institution.
And I was surprised that I would have been surprised if you told me, you know, this is going to go on for years and it's going to remain fresh and it's going to remain important. But two shows have really risen to, they're sort of like they're mirror images of each other. And, you know, one is Hell's Kitchen,
uh-huh.
and the other is Top Chef. And I think, look, I have nothing against Gordon Ramsay personally, although we've said that we don't like his show and what they demonstrate there, which is a humiliation fest and a lot of anger and not in pursuit of excellence. I think it's gratuitous. While I'm not, Gordon Ramsay's an excellent chef.
He's an excellent chef, but it's the Bart Simpsonizing of television.
It's just there's no reason for human beings to treat each other like that. It doesn't encourage or promote excellence. And I think on the other hand, you have Tom Colicchio, who is just, you know, we had met Tom once or twice. I don't even know if he would have remembered us before he came on the show, but since the show, we've talked to him a number of times and run into him. He is just the most dignified, even-keeled, you know, he's perfect on that show, and I think
he offers criticism, and see that's the part of this
criticism.
The part of this that I think that shouldn't be overlooked is people make mistakes, and you need to correct those mistakes. And some mistakes are unacceptable, and sometimes you get knocked off the show because you made an unacceptable mistake.
Right,
but you can do that with dignity. You can do that with class. You can do that with grace.
But and I think this translates to a lot of life. When you have somebody who, even in our own organization, you have somebody who is marginal. Maybe they're starting to fail in a high stress situation. Maybe in boot camp, when you're training for combat, the thing to do is to lean on that person and try and break them. The Army does that in basic training. They don't do that in combat. You know why? You don't want to break your person down and have them burst into tears, even if they have made a mistake, in an actual combat situation and in a service situation. And that's what Gordon Ramsay does. It's like he tries to belittle and break down people. Whereas the point is to build people up, and when they don't make it, you got to point that out, and it's just, it's totally different scenario. So anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa?
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
It's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website. Ask for the Restaurant Guys promo or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. And our guest today is Michael Ruhlman, who joins us again. He's one of our favorite food authors. You may have seen him as a judge on the TV Food Network's The Next Iron Chef. He's author of The Making of a Chef, The Reach of a Chef, Walk on Water, and he's a frequent contributor to The Restaurant Guys radio show.
Hey, Michael, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here.
You know, we want to talk today about, because I know you've written about Michael Pollan's open letter to the president, which touches on a number of issues that you write about and we've talked about all the time, and I really like the way you treated those issues and put them in perspective. But there are two other issues I want to talk about first, and the first is an article you wrote called The Fallacy of the Quick and Easy Cookbook.
Yes, indeed.
And, you know, it's funny. A friend of mine was sort of affectionately mocking a book, Andrea Immer, who's a wonderful master sommelier and friend and a great wine professional and an author who writes some valuable stuff and does a lot of valuable stuff. But her mutual friend who is a master of wine was kidding when she came out with her first book, which was called Great Wine Made Simple. And he said, you know what, Francis? I said, what's that? He said, I want to write a book, and that's going to be Great Wine Ain't Simple. which is sort of what you talk about. If it's quick and easy to make the kind of food that Alain Ducasse makes, why would we pay so much money for it?
Yeah, we want our cake, and we want to have our cake and eat it too. It's people want great food, but they don't want to do any work, or it's, you know, so many people come up to me, tell me a great meal I can make in 15 minutes. Steak. You know, that's a great meal. Get some good cheese and some nice truffled honey and some bread and a bottle of wine and a salad.
And so, by the way, and
so what you're saying though is we want our cake and we want it to be in a box.
I don't know what people want or what people expect, but the fact is, if you want good food, you got to cook it, or you got to just buy it already made. You know, buy some great salumi.
Well, you know, though, I think that you can have great, simple food, but to say something, the oxymoron is Alain Ducasse made simple, because
that's what drove me. That's what made me crazy, and that's why I wrote about it. You're absolutely right. I've forgotten what got me on that jag in the first place. You know, it's ludicrous. Who are the publishers who are making a decision that this can actually be done, that people will buy into this?
But they do, yeah. Right?
We can't be that stupid, are we?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We're dumber than that.
We finally elected a decent president We've got to be getting smarter. We've realized that the errors of our stupid decision making.
I'm going to say we're not getting smarter. We're just not getting dumber. How's that?
I don't know. I just think we're tired, and we're like, all right, this isn't working. Now, on an ongoing way, in the New York Times, you have Michael Bittman's column. Mark Bittman's column, which he often takes and has written books where he's worked with great chefs like Dukas. And then made simpler versions of things that you can make at home. But it's all very tongue-in-cheek. It's you have some of the same flavors involved, but he makes no claim to have the same complexity and depth that a great chef makes. I mean, there are times when you go for the special occasion and the great effort to make a complex and detailed dish, and there are times that you throw something on the stove and whip it up. You know, I think it's the lack of a distinction between those two.
There's a reason we take 15 hours to make a veal stock.
It devalues it if you say, oh, well, you can make anything in 10 minutes. You know, it seems like a waste of time to do anything else then, doesn't it?
Well, I couldn't agree more with you, and you're saying it even more articulately than I have been. So perhaps I should just listen to your show.
I get a little pissed off, and it rolls. I don't know if it's articulate, but it's certainly forceful.
You should be pissed off. I mean, it's wrong thinking, and I think we always have to point out wrong thinking when we see it.
Well, let's talk about wrong thinking writ large, or maybe right thinking writ large. Michael Pollan wrote this very long piece. Michael Pollan, the food author, wrote Omnivore's Dilemma and many other wonderful books, about, you know, we have an opportunity for change here, and we have a president-elect who has not started making decisions yet about how to correct the food system, the whole food system.
Dilemma. Let's call it a dilemma, because that's what we have right now. We have a food dilemma.
And he makes some rather radical suggestions, but he posits that this whole thing is broken, and what's not already broken and causing hunger and obesity and bad economics in the short term shortly will be catastrophic, like the financial markets were unsustainable and could hit a catastrophic explosion. He points to a number of ways that we can change things to maybe avoid this catastrophe. Before we talk about the specifics, do you think there's any chance that there could be the political will to change these things before the bottom falls out and there is this catastrophe? Or do we need to wait for an explosion and for people to start dying more than they already are before this changes?
That's a good question. Of course, I'm skeptical because of the power of big industry and the lobbyists in Washington. They are difficult to surmount, especially from the grassroots. My hope is that more and more people will care about their food, will start spending a little more for organic milk and grass-fed beef and keep farmers in the black financially.
Well, you know, but
if more and more people do this, then supply and demand will take care of itself.
Well, you know, but I think one of Pollan's points that he comes back to in this article as well as in a lot of his other writing, and I think you and we have spoken about in the past, is that you know, it takes an amount of political change to fundamentally change the paradigm, because just good small business people, consumers who want to buy and producers who want to produce, face incredible hurdles, including restrictions and regulations that are really designed to keep the small player out.
Right.
So talk to us about your views on some of the things in the Pollan article. I can suggest them, or you can just go.
First of all, is to get more small farmers out there, to elevate the prestige of farmer, to make farmers become cool. And I think that as more and more chefs play up or elevate and put on pedestals their own growers, we will start respecting them. They're going to be the next, I hope, you know, wouldn't it be great if the next breed of celebrity food people were the people who are making this food, like Diane St. Clair and her butter, or Keith Martin and his lamb. These guys need to be valued. They need to be praised. I would even go so far as to say glorified if they're really doing great work. And that would be a good step. It would encourage more people to do this very hard, not very remunerative work.
Well, I'll tell you, Michael, one of the reasons that we asked you on the show today is because, you know, Pollan's article is a little bit verbose, and I think that a lot of people just kind of might skim through it. But I've really felt that you broke the article down into bullet points so those of us who have a short attention span could really sink our teeth into it.
Well, it's funny because I was at some conference and I was talking about the article, and I asked how many, these were all food people, they were personal chefs, a group of personal chefs, and I asked them how many had read this article the week before, and like 3 out of 50 raised their hand, and these are food people. I couldn't believe that. So I went. So then I said, okay, well, here's what the article is about, and I gave sort of an overview, and then I couldn't remember a single point he'd really made, and mm-hmm. I thought, God, how appalling is that? Am I just a nitwit? So I went back on the plane home from that conference. I went through reread the article again and isolated all these wonderful points that he made and made a bullet point list of it. And I'm glad I did because a lot of people responded. It makes it very clear what the points are, what he's saying. I think it was very helpful. Bourdain told me Mario was shipping it around the country to various people, getting them to read it. So that was flattering.
Well, I'll tell you, when the article first came out, I brought up, did exactly what you did. I mean, I started talking about people at the bar and the restaurants and started talking to people about the article, and very, very few people had read it. And I don't know if it was just that it was too long. Whatever the case was, it seemed like it didn't get the readership it deserved.
They needed to have a bullet point list included in the article. That's what they failed to do.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that he's saying. The criticism of the article, as from people who got the information through you or who read the article primarily or who did one and then the other. People are saying that these are radical changes that fly in the face of the way our economy works. And they are, but they're necessary. I mean, we have set up a system where calories are cheap, food is cheap, and the worst kind of food is what's cheapest and most accessible. And it takes government intervention to change this because it is with government intervention that this was set up. The current food system wouldn't exist, because a lot of modern agribusiness, when you start talking about stuff like that, will say, well, you can't really intervene in the market. Yet they're the largest receiver of government subsidies and the largest consumer of fossil fuels after automobiles. That was a shocking piece in the article. Agriculture is the largest consumer of fossil fuel after automobiles. Where do you stand on that? Or have you been talking to people about the idea that, maybe this is too much for government to take on, or it's not in government's business to step in and do these things?
What Paul, I think, would say to that is, and one of his points is, that we need to build an infrastructure for a regional food economy so that we didn't have to ship everything to ourselves or ship everything all over the country. An infrastructure that could encourage and support the farms and distribute what they grow. That's one way to do it, to maintain farmland that we already have and not give it over to real estate, which is what we've been doing. He says we need to provide cities grants with which to build structures for year-round farmers markets. We have a great farmers market here in Cleveland, which is, this is Rust Belt here. This is a great, declining urban city. And I can get grass-fed beef all year round now because there's a guy here growing it and grows plenty of it. I can get chickens all year round. I can get all this wonderful stuff, especially meat. All year round, and the vegetables, of course, in the summertime.
Well, one of the things I like about Pollan's plan for regional food supply is we can use one of the tactics of the last administration. We can use fear. The terrorists are going to come and destroy, all of our spinach or all of our pork in one fell swoop.
Yeah, it's a good point. Americans do respond to fear very well, and it's safer to do what Pollan is saying.
Sure, it's safer and more stable and more sustainable. And creating infrastructure, that is what a government's supposed to do. At the very least, the government creates the infrastructure of the stock market. It creates the Securities and Exchange Commissions and the rules and regulations. And so, I don't buy that government can't get involved. Government is involved. It just needs to change the way that it's involved and change the ends that it seeks.
Couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
You talk about one of these, the benefits that you now see because some things have become regional. Francis and I looked for grass-fed beef for years without being able to find a non-frozen product because these slaughterhouses are so large
and centralized
that you had that anybody who's breeding grass-fed cows had to ship their cows so far away that it had to be frozen in order to be shipped.
And that's because the government regulations are such that it makes it's very difficult to open a small regional slaughterhouse. It has
right.
to be regional.
All their regulations have to do with these big massive places and food safety. They need to government needs to change these regulations.
Well, you know what? We're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back and talk more with Michael Rollman about the state of agriculture and food in America. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking, rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the seven most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. We're speaking with Michael Rollman, one of our favorite food authors, about the state of agriculture today in America and the precipice of a new presidential administration. Who knows what kind of a change we'll see. But we have a list of what we can hope for. You can find out more about what Michael Rollman thinks about a lot of these things if you go to blog.rollman.com. Michael, one of the things that is discussed in the Pollen article, which you've discussed as well, is changing the paradigm of our agricultural system from a petroleum-based agricultural system to a sun-based agricultural system. A statistic that we've heard before that not many, you know, may not be out there, is that in the 1950s, it took 1 calorie of fossil fuel to create 3 calories of food for people, and now it takes 10 calories of fossil fuel to create 1 or 2 calories of food for us?
Yeah, it's a crazy situation, and again, Pollen is very has made this idea very appealing and interesting. And you know, we've taken this really elegant situation in which animals graze on grass, they grow, their waste helps fertilize the land. We've separated,
which makes more grass for the next animals, and it all stays there.
Exactly, it's an elegant system, and we've cut it in half to make 2 horrible systems. One. We've contained our animals in vast feedlots, in concentrated animal feedlots, and we have
where getting rid of their waste is such a problem. Then
we've created just oceans of their waste that is now a horrific problem rather than an elegant solution. And we are growing them on corn, which is fuel produced, rather than on grass, which was free. It grew all over the place.
Yeah. So what we've created this twofold problem that Michael's talking about, where we took the cows off the farm, so now that we have all their waste to get rid of, and now the farms all need to be fertilized by petroleum-based products.
They need antibiotics, and they're fed corn, and all these things require fossil fuels.
And it just doesn't make any sense, where if we had smaller farms that were more diversified, you could rotate all of these things around your farm, and that's the traditional way to do it, and it's certainly a better system.
Well, and one of the points you make is basically we have a diet now where we're eating oil. I mean, we're eating our eating food causes oil to be burned, causes gases to release into the atmosphere that exacerbate the climate change, but also it makes us dependent on foreign oil. Forget the fact that we're now dependent on these very concentrated feedlots and very concentrated farms, where you know a problem in one farm affects, as we see, you know, a recall now of spinach goes across the country if it was from one distributor. But you also have the dependence on the oil that's necessary to keep this unsustainable system working. So when you talk about things like, you know, preserve every acre of farmland we currently have, the government has an interest in doing that. And maybe it needs to compensate the landowners and buy the development rights. But it's time for a Manhattan Project. It's time to do something because this system will crash. I mean, do you think that this system is destined to crash in a big way? Or can it just fade away?
It's hard to say. I don't think it will crash. I think we're doing things now that are going to ensure that at least some good food properly produced is available. And as more and more people want that and demand it, there's going to be more and more of it. What's going to happen? What's going to happen 50 years from now? It's going to be our view will shift to the foreign stage, I think, because we're going to have like 10 billion people on Earth, and 80% of them are going to live in urban areas, and these people are going to need food, and perhaps big business is the way to do it. I don't know. I don't know how we're going to feel. Certainly, big business argues that they're the way to feed the world.
But
people argue against it, say, no, let's just teach them how to produce food. Let's teach them how to do it.
But the problem when you produce row-to-row corn in a monoculture like that is it takes so much energy to produce that year after year after year, where if you use the land in a more sustainable way, you could indeed end up feeding more people from that land over a 100-year period.
Well, I'm just to throw something out there, Michael, I'm curious as to what you think about this. Here, the private sector, properly regulated, is probably the most powerful engine for getting things done that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And business without accountability, because, let's face it, business is, they're spending other people's money and there's less accountability there. But I think that big business unfettered may be good at short-term decisions, because basically anybody who owns a company, you want to make your profit and get out.
Mm-hmm.
But you need government. We need to make some long-term decisions that may not make the most profit in the short term. And we need to have regulations that say, listen, if you make decisions that may make you a lot of profit by concentrating production and for even 10 or 20 years be the most profitable way to run, but at the end of 20 years, we've lost all of our small farms, we've lost our regional food distribution system, and we're left with a centralized food system that is then unsustainable, you can't make a profit on that and get out. We need to regulate away your ability to do that.
It's true. And running our food system on the capitalist model almost ensures that we have cheap products. Without some regulation, it's going to just keep getting cheaper and cheaper and worse and worse.
But artificially cheap. The problem is it
artificially cheap.
Is all the costs are not in there.
Absolutely. We don't figure in the healthcare dollars that this costs us.
And
the cost of the environment and all that stuff. It's ugly business the way we've been producing food, and we're just waking up to it now.
You mentioned the healthcare costs, and that was another great point in Pollan's article. In 1960, he writes that we were spending 5% of our income on healthcare. And now we're spending 16% of our income on healthcare. And at the time, we were spending 18% of our income on food, and now we're spending 10% of our income on food. Well, basically, all we've done is transferred our expense from food to healthcare. I mean, that's basically the transformation we've made.
And in the meantime, made our food worse and trashed our country.
Yeah, it's funny because when we talk about things being cheap, cheap food, having a Walmart open up outside your town may get you some cheaper food for a time. But, there are other costs. And it's hard to argue with people and say, food shouldn't be that cheap. But food shouldn't be that. I mean, let's cut it down. We don't have a problem with people starving in America, and we need to make sure that everybody has enough food. Our problem is many of our poor people, as the rest of us, are fat, are obese, have diabetes, have high blood pressure, and
more of our poor people.
And that's a crazy dichotomy, isn't it?
Yeah. How does that happen? I mean, that just bespeaks the awfulness of the food that we're producing.
But it makes someone arguing for a reasonable position, which is to say we should have good food, even if it's a little more expensive. It makes it sound like, well, you're trying to starve out poor people, and no, I'm just trying to get them. To offer them different options and to change the culture to make it that the path of least resistance is not a McDonald's hamburger.
Exactly. We have to change the culture. We have to change the way people think. and that takes time.
Well, if you would like to look at how Michael Roman thinks, and that's a pretty good and well-informed way to look at things, you can go to blog.roman.com or your www.roman.com, and of course you can link through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Michael, thanks for coming on the show again.
Pleasure to be here.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Michael. To talk to you. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com and WCTCAM.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Michael Roman, smart dude.
Smart guy, really, really, and he did a great job breaking down that Michael Pollan, also a super smart dude.
Well, but what I have to say is go to Roman's blog. It's really, I read it as often as I can. He's a smart guy in his own right. I thought it was interesting to hear him talk about the Pollan article.
Yeah, he did a great job kind of breaking out the points that Pollan made. But one of the great points in the Pollan article are, in order for us to change the way we're doing this, in order for us to change the whole paradigm, agriculture used to be a much more labor-intensive job. It took a lot more people to farm than it does now. And you drive on your truck and you fertilize and you spray the fertilizer and you drive on your truck and you
right. So and you collect small the farms corn. With very few people are now. I'm sorry. Small farm operations, people wise, are now farming hundreds of acres
exactly.
Using modern chemicals and modern technology.
So we're gonna need more people if we're gonna get involved back and re-involved with it. But I have to say, what better time than right now? Okay, since the market crashed, we've lost over 2 million jobs. There are 2 million people who are jobless now who were not jobless 3 months ago. What better time than to create a government training program to get people back into the farms and to change the way we do this.
But here's the problem. You cannot do that and have the free market function for food. The free market does not function with food as it does in other commodities. Look.
Well, you have to change the whole structure.
Right. Well, but what I'm saying is not just the structure. You have to, and let's face it, if you want that to work, what you've got to do is say, okay, cheap rice from China, sorry, not can't come into the country because if you don't, or has to have 100% tariff.
The other thing you have to do is you have to say, okay, here's this land that's been cordoned off. As long as you pledge to farm in this certain way, We're gonna let you use this land that was otherwise being protected.
But I think you still have a problem because you have still, say you do that. Say you set up all these farms and you train all these workers and you get them all out there and you give them some help. If you don't stop subsidizing large agribusiness farms, and let's face it.
Well, of course, that's got to be part of the change.
Okay,
subsidizing large agribusiness farms has to. You can't force a small farmer to compete with somebody who you're paying.
Okay, so let's be sure that everybody out in the audience knows that American subsidies to we don't pay farmer subsidies. We pay crop subsidies,
and only for a very few crops, which is why those crops dominate our countryside.
And for the crops that, you know, we artificially drive the price down, and we say produce as much as you can, even when it floods the market with cheap corn, we subsidize the growing of that crop, which is different than it was 25 years ago when there was a price floor guaranteed for farmers. So it sounds like a subtle difference, but it's a very important difference. But what basically has to happen is we have to stop throwing these large subsidies to our own agribusiness corporations, mammoth agribusiness corporations, to grow food that we don't need, to make it cheaper than it needs to be, because let's face it, that's just corporate welfare. Yes, your food in the supermarket is cheaper, but your taxes are higher to pay the corporations
to make that food
cheaper, and they get their piece all along the way.
I think if we're going to make food artificially cheaper, it should be the best food, not necessarily the worst
food.
Yeah,
we should be subsidizing vegetables and local farms. And
not high fructose corn syrup.
And
feeding corn to our cows when they really probably be better off if they were eating grass.
But to subsidize local farms, which is what it's going to take to make this change, and to stop subsidizing those large agribusiness farms, and when you have other countries that have begun to do a similar sort of destructive agriculture, you're going to have to put...
Free trade is not necessarily the answer.
You're not going to be able to go with free trade on this, and I don't think there's a problem with that. We need to preserve the farms in this country, and we need to get healthier, and you should go to Michael Roman's blog and read it, and you should listen to our show all the time. Now go and have some good food and eat your vegetables. Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascoe.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.